Hello and welcome. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Last night, Donald Trump was in town rallying thousands of supporters at Comcast Arena in Everett.
And you know, on television, they said, I wonder why he's going to the state of Washington, because you know what? Republicans don't win it, but we're going to win it. That's why I'm here.
KUOW's David Hyde was there, and I asked him about Trump's talk of winning in Washington state.
That's what he says. That's what Senator Don Benton said as well. He told that to the crowd. But they know a Republican hasn't won this state since Ronald Reagan, and they know that Hillary Clinton's got a double-digit lead in most of the polls.
Besides all the winning, what did Trump talk about last night?
Jobs, jobs, jobs. He talked a lot about jobs and how he's going to keep them here.
We're bringing jobs back to our country. We're not going to let people take our jobs anymore. We're not going to let our jobs go to other countries anymore. There will be retribution. There will be a price to pay.
A price to pay. What is his plan there? How's he going to keep jobs here?
We've heard before he says that trade deals kill jobs. He also talked about Hillary Clinton's immigration policy and jobs.
It brings in illegal immigrants and refugees to take jobs from our hardworking African-American and Hispanic citizens, and they want those jobs.
All right, jobs, immigration, refugees, what else, David?
Well, I learned something last night that Donald Trump is a huge poetry fan, just like you.
Oh.
On her way to work one morning, down the path along the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor, half-frozen snake.
So this is called The Snake, and he read the whole thing just like that to the crowd in the Comcast Arena, and it was just kind of a moment.
I'm not familiar with this poem, David. What is this leading to, the parable of the snake?
In Trump's imagination, this is a metaphor for Syrian refugees, because in the speech last night, we learned that some refugees are here to take your jobs, and others are here to kill you. It turns out The Snake is actually an R&B song.
To work one morning down the path alongside the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor half-frozen snake.
Do you know Al Wilson?
I don't even know Al Wilson.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of him either. Huh. But anyway, that's the song. It was actually written by this guy, the late Oscar Brown Jr., who was a performer and social activist. And his family is telling Trump to please stop reading it in his events. Brown's daughter, Maggie Brown, reportedly said if her dad were still alive, he would have ripped Trump with a great poem in rebuttal. Not only a poem and a song, but an essay and everything else.
Well, I will give it to Donald Trump. He goes deeper on 60s R&B than I do. What other music was there last night, David?
A lot of Rolling Stones. Must be a huge Rolling Stones fan. Although the feeling's not mutual, the Rolling Stones have asked the Trump campaign to stop playing their music. But one of my favorite moments was before it all started, and a few people in the crowd were dancing to that Daft Punk song, Get Lucky.
Get Lucky. Is that Trump saying the only way I'm going to win Washington State is through incredible fortune?
There might have been some hidden meaning there. I don't know.
KUOW's David Hyde was at the Xfinity Arena in Everett last night, where Donald Trump was talking immigration, among other things. And we're actually going to revisit that topic in just a few minutes. We're going to introduce you to one of the thousands of refugees trying to make it here in Washington state. Trump is talking immigration in another country today. He's left Everett. He's in Mexico City now, meeting with President Enrique Peña Nieto, which is an odd pairing, given the feuding those two have been doing over Trump saying Mexico is going to pay for a border wall. In fact, at the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute, Luis Rubio says both sides have got something to lose with this meeting.
This is going to be a very awkward meeting where there's no language in common, where there is no previous understanding of what the issues are, and where therefore there's an enormous risk being taken, probably by both sides, but I think that mostly by Mexico.
After that meeting in Mexico, Donald Trump goes to Phoenix today for that major speech on his immigration policy. And you will, of course, hear coverage of both the Mexico meeting and the Phoenix immigration speech later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered.
Merhaba.
Ni hao.
Hello.
Bonjour.
Namaste. Yes,
hey.
Ciao.
Hello.
In the last 5 years, Washington State has brought in more than 16,000 refugees, and we are introducing you to a few of them. KUOW's Liz Jones followed three refugees through their first year in the Seattle area. Yesterday, we heard the first half of Tutu's story. He's a young refugee from Burma who came here alone to live with relatives. When his story left off, Tutu was determined to study English, but also feeling pressure to get a job.
This is Tutu on his first day in America, trying to spell his name for a caseworker.
It's Amo too now.
And here he is 6 months later.
Okay, let's go.
In English class.
That's good.
I take the seat next to him.
Hi. How are you?
Good. And you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Almost since he arrived, Tutu has approached English like a full-time job, and it's paying off. We start to have conversations. I ask what's up with his cell phone.
My phone is not good.
Not working?
Yeah,
not working. What happened?
I don't know. I send money back. I can't use it.
Oh, okay. That's okay. I call at your house.
Yes.
Appointment.
Yes.
Yeah.
He takes the bus to class, about an hour each way, four nights a week. He arrives early, sits in the front, and confidently calls out answers.
Good. Maybe three.
He makes his classmates laugh.
Oh. What did you say?
Just kidding.
You make a joke?
Yeah.
Class wraps up, and Tutu heads for the bus home.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So we'll talk more next week.
Yes. Okay, good night.
Good night.
Have a good day. Goodbye, teacher.
Bye. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
His teacher says he's well-liked and he works hard. She thinks he'll do well here. Tutu has mentioned before that he'd like to be an interpreter someday. But the odds are against him when it comes to English fluency. In census surveys, roughly 1 out of 5 Burmese people in the U.S. say they speak English well. The rest will find their worlds limited in many ways, especially in the job market.
Hi, Tu.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
At the 10-month mark, I visit Tutu a final time at his cousin's apartment. Something's changed. He recently turned 21, so I brought him a birthday card. He scratches at the envelope.
You didn't know?
You gave up already? Tu, you should learn to open this.
It's striking how many little things are still foreign to him, like a manila envelope.
Happy birthday. Thank you.
I mentioned that 21 is a big birthday in America, but it doesn't register. I turn to the interpreter.
Do you know why?
Yeah, of course. Everything is legal. you can go to clubs and...
But Tutu's not interested in any of that. His cousin helped him land a temp job with a big manufacturer in Redmond. He solders together electronic parts for $13 an hour. And at work, his conversation skills are expanding.
I know... Hasta mañana. And salud. And gracias.
Most of his coworkers speak Spanish. Tutu stuck with English classes for the first 8 months, as planned. But now, there's no more time. His relatives have worked similar factory jobs for years, and perhaps he will too. Compared to all refugees in the U.S., Burmese are among the most likely to stay in low-wage jobs due to low levels of education. But it's still early days for this community here. More success will likely come with time. Tutu seems proud of his job. He helps pay the rent. He's paying off the travel loan for his flight to the U.S., and he sent $500 to his father back in Thailand.
He said that my grandma is still sick. And they need help and they need money. So he sent money.
When Tutu arrived here, his dad told him to only call home every 3 months. Maybe he thought that would make the transition easier. And maybe it did. It seems Tutu has grown up a lot this past year. He's passed into adulthood. He says life here is good. It's not what he expected, but he's not really sure what he expected. He misses family back home and familiar surroundings, and sometimes he'll ask a friend to drive him to a nearby park.
It's kind of far. More like in like a mountain, like, so I can hear like the sound of the river and birds.
It sounds like the mountain village where he grew up, thousands of miles away, and it makes him happy. In Kent, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
So we just heard what Tutu has been going through trying to make it in the United States. Now let's look at the challenges caseworkers face as they try to help refugees. Nikki Smith runs the International Rescue Committee in Seattle. She's lived all over the world working with refugees. She told Kim Malcolm, even as welcoming as Washington State is, she can't successfully help refugees resettle unless she gets a lot of help from others.
We work with everybody from volunteers who give up their time to support families, to having great support from the local police department, the fire department, to the city council, particularly great support from the mayor's office.
Schools?
The school system, the library system. You know, it's a really extensive network of support that we need to help provide all the support that's helpful for refugee resettlement. And the thing that's wonderful about it is that, you know, people really want to do this. They really want to see families succeed. And that's what's remarkable about the community approach.
What would you say is the number one biggest challenge you face when you're working with a new refugee?
So the number one biggest challenge is the housing issue. So just trying to find affordable housing is really tough. And we work with a huge amount of partners to be able to identify and locate housing. So then when we have our family in, it's the English is the next challenge. Getting English class, getting them up to speed with their English lessons and really helping them understand the cultural differences between the U.S. and their country of origin.
What should we know about the money they receive that helps support them as they're looking for housing and as they're dealing with all the other things that are coming at them in their new life?
So I would say that it's a lot less than people imagine. People think that they get a lot of money, and reality is they don't. They get anywhere between $800 and $1,000 per person, and that's a one-off payment, and that's all they receive. They also receive some benefits from King County, but the important aspect for them is to get a job. These people don't want to be on benefits. They don't want assistance. They want to be able to start working as quickly as possible so that they can raise money for their families and really supply their families' needs.
Other than funding, is there anything else that would make settling in easier for refugees?
We're really grateful for volunteer help. You know, the volunteers are a critical part of our program, as I mentioned before.
And what kind of work do they do for you?
They are so amazing. We have them in our community garden helping out. We have them do in-house tutoring with some of our kids so that they can get up to speed quickly with their English or their math skills and their science skills. We have them mentor a family so the entire family gets support, and that's everything from how to go shopping to how to manage a bank account. And so then they would feel really welcome when they arrive.
There's been a lot of political rhetoric around severely restricting the number of refugees into the country in this election year. Are you seeing any effects of that in your work?
So we resettle in Washington State, which is an incredibly welcoming state. And we're very fortunate that we are living in such a welcoming state. We have programs. The International Rescue Committee has 28 offices around the U.S., the welcome in other states is not as obvious as it is in Washington State. But having said that, I feel that when you read the newspapers and you hear the news, it's not an indicator of often what's happening at a community level.
How so?
So it seems very anti-refugee right now. And yet when we're working in the community, we get many voices of welcome, people who really want to help refugees and welcome refugees into their community. They recognize that the U.S. was founded off immigrants and refugees. And so they realize that they really can contribute towards society and to the community and make it a richer and happier place.
How do they stay optimistic in the face of those kinds of challenges?
So I don't think you will ever meet a more resilient group of people in the world. I mean, these people have been through things that we can barely imagine, and they're survivors. So they are determined to succeed. You know, they have reached to what they've achieved to get to the point to getting being resettled in America is enormous. So there is 59 million people displaced in the world right now, and about 25 million refugees, and less than 1% of that 25 million get resettled.
Less than 1%?
Less than 1%.
So they are the winners of the lottery.
This is the golden ticket winner, right? They really have won the golden ticket. I mean, they are determined to to build a life here in America, because the thought of what they came from is unthinkable. You know, they've left. I work with a staff member, a colleague, and he was 17 years in a refugee camp in Nepal. He lived in a tent for 17 years of his life after being thrown off his land from Bhutan. So could I do that? That would be a really tough ask. I think most of us would really fail if we were forced to be refugees.
Working with refugees sounds like it can be difficult, though. Many of these folks are traumatized. It can be emotionally draining work, what you're doing.
Yeah.
Why do you do it?
I feel like very fortunate. I feel like I've won what I call the birth lottery. I'm very fortunate in that the fact that I was born in the UK to my family, and I have friends who were born in Eritrea or Somalia or Sudan or Congo, which are far harsher climates to be born into and to be raised. And they have things outside of their control, and one of those things is conflict. And, you know, I have friends who I met overseas, and all of their adult life, they've been in war. And so for me, I feel very committed to refugee issues. I feel like they can contribute so much to our world. These are great people. They're families. You know, this is the thing when the term refugee seems so isolating. It can be quite negative now, unfortunately, the image when it springs to mind when you say refugee. But for me, I see a family. I see a kid who, the Syrian family that we resettled last September, spoke no English, a family of six, and now the 15-year-old is, you know, at the top of his class in the high school. And
really?
The 5-year-old is speaking fluent English with a nice American accent. And the mom is studying to run her own daycare center. And the dad and the oldest son are working in a restaurant. And that, for me, is the refugee that when I have it in my mind's eye, it's that Syrian family, or it's the Somali family, or it's, you know, the Vietnamese person who got resettled 20 years ago and is now working in our office. You know, I see much more positive aspects to refugees.
For somebody listening to you in the car right now, or someone who doesn't see or speak with refugees in the course of their regular life, what would you like them to know about the work you're doing?
So I feel very privileged to work with refugee clients. I think that they're incredible families that we resettle. We have the chance for them to really leave a country that's torn apart by conflict, where they've been fled for their lives. I mean, the thing that connects refugees, whether they're Vietnamese, Congolese, Haitians, Cubans, is that they've had a well-founded fear of persecution. So they've been able to demonstrate that their lives and their families' lives were in jeopardy. So they've come to the US, and there are difficulties, but there are so many success stories, whether that is graduating from school or getting a job or learning English. I mean, these are wonderful families, wonderful people who they would love to build friends in the community as well. So it's a great opportunity to spend some time with a different culture and learn from them.
Nikki Smith is Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Seattle, and this interview is part of our series called Upon Arrival. You can find photos and more stories online at KUOW.org. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow is the first day of September, and it's First Thursday, when Seattle celebrates art with galleries open late, museums offering free admission. And this month, Strangers art critic Jen Graves wants you to know about the photographer Dean Wong. For the past 4 decades, Wong has been taking photos of Chinatowns across the United States. Jen saw some of Dean's photos of Seattle's Chinatown, and they stuck with her. So she got in touch with Dean to see if he would show her Chinatown through his eyes. She wasn't expecting his first response.
Why should I?
Who are fair you? Question.
I love that.
Why should he?
It was great. And I was like, well, fair question. And so I wrote, you know, what I hoped was a convincing explanation of why I was interested in his work. So,
why does he so want to document Chinatown?
He takes these photographs, and people say to him, oh, those are beautiful. When are you going back to Asia to photograph that again? People don't seem to know what USA Chinatowns really look like. They don't seem to really look at them closely, don't even seem to recognize their own city's Chinatowns. But in addition to that, you know, there's been tons of news about the decline of Chinatowns in the last few years. And so I think he's really, really involved and invested in saying this place exists, this place persists.
Dean Wong was best friends with Donnie Chin,
yes,
who died not long ago, a community leader, a sort of first responder mm-hmm. of that neighborhood. What, how has that connection affected Dean's work?
Well, everybody knows about Donnie, but not that many people know about Dean, and I think outside the ID. And I think, you know, if Donnie was the protector, Dean is the portraitist. And if you look, you used to ask Donnie when you wanted to know something about the history. And I think 25 years from now, when you want to know something about the history, you're going to look at Dean's photographs. So I think, you know, it's difficult for me to speculate on how Donnie's death affects Dean's work. But I would say there's a sense of urgency there, you know, for him. And I think for me, it was interesting just to note that, like, he's this other pillar in that community, Dean is.
What's a favorite Dean Wong photograph of yours?
You know, I like when he captures multiple generations. There's one that I think about particularly where he's got a young man in the foreground who's holding this, like, really loud, bright parade costume over his head, sort of proclaiming his identity, his Chinese pride. And then you've got the older guy in the background who you barely see at first. You don't notice him at all. And then you see him, and he's just looking right past that younger man and looking right past this display of identity. He's like, I'm past it. I need to go. It's like a Tuesday. I have to get my shoes fixed. I have to, you know, he's like living this very daily routine life. And so Dean is getting at both this kind of public display of Chinatown and also the sort of private identities and private lives that are happening all the time in Chinatowns.
What is Dean Wong's work teach us about Seattle's Chinatown?
I think Dean's work teaches us to look at Seattle's Chinatown, period. I mean, I think there's a sense of there's a decent amount of, like, sort of passing tourism in Chinatown where you sort of kind of go through there maybe, or you go to your favorite places there only. And Dean's work really cements the idea that it is a place that is full of stuff you haven't seen, even if you've been there many times. And I certainly got that feeling going through there with him. I was like, wow, this neighborhood has got so much more in every square inch than I was noticing at all. And I go there all the time. So, you know, I really think that what his work shows is just Seattle's Chinatown is very, very much alive, very detailed, very complex, and very much worth looking again at.
Jen Graves is the art critic for The Stranger. You can see Dean Wong's photographs at Jack Straw Cultural Center in the University District, but only if you hurry because the show closes on Friday. Dean Wong's book of photographs is called Seeing the Light, 4 Decades in Chinatown. Seattle is so rich in art, but as you may know, for some artists, this is just not an affordable place to keep working. One solution to that is to look east, over the Cascades, to a place like Tyatin, Washington, a little rural town near Yakima. Only about 1,000 people live there. But today, it is home to an arts incubator called Mighty Tyatin, started by a man from Seattle. Ed Marquand first came to Tyatin in 2005, and since then, artists from Seattle and Portland have moved their production there. Producer Phoebe Flanagan told me a little of Tyatin's history.
You know, it had been this kind of booming sort of Main Street town that you sort of imagine when you think about rural America in the 50s, right? The sort of like Norman Rockwell ideal with these little barbershops and movie theaters and bustling local restaurants, things like that. But through sort of the 80s and 90s, you see this shift where changes in the global economy started to change the character of the place. So first, there's this, it's a big agricultural town. That's kind of the main industry there.
Orchards.
The apple orchards, especially. So as agribusiness becomes sort of the the bigger force in how things are made and sold, it gets harder and harder for the family farms that were kind of the lifeblood of Tyotin to survive. So you see big changes on that side. And with that sort of a shifting demographic in the town, at the turn of the century, the town was about 70% white, and now it's 70% Hispanic. So that was one big piece of it. There's this demographic shift. There's a shift in the nature of industry. And then the other piece of that is, you know, Yakima, which is a pretty big city relative to the area, is only about 20 minutes away. And as these sort of big box stores move into Yakima, it becomes more cost effective for people to just drive into town instead of shopping at the local mom and pops. So at the same time that you're seeing this shift in the agricultural economy, there's also the sort of main square, this beautiful little square in the middle of town that used to be filled with business, kind of dries up and blows away.
So then in 2005, this artist, entrepreneur, fine art bookmaker, Ed Marquand, buys up a bunch of empty warehouses in Tyotin. Why did he do that? What did he see in Tyotin?
So he kind of ended up in Tyotin on accident. He was on this bike ride and he got a flat tire. And so he's sitting there sort of patching his tire in this town square, looking around and notices all these vacant warehouses, these empty storefronts right along the town square. And he had been thinking for a while, he runs a business out of Seattle that's very successful. It's like a arts book business, Marquand Editions.
Beautiful books.
Beautiful books, unlike anything I've ever seen. So he needed to sort of expand his production space. And he had a lot of friends who were also different creative entrepreneurs who had sort of tried and true businesses that they were already running who needed more production space. And it was getting really expensive in Seattle to afford that sort of space to expand. So Tyotin was kind of one thing that he said to me over and over again is we couldn't have done this anywhere, but there was something about the town. And part of it was just these beautiful buildings along the town square that sort of for him inspired creativity. And he could see it as maybe like a place that tourists might like to come. It's not just like buildings along a highway. There's sort of a, I don't know. It's beautiful. It's beautiful there.
Why did Ed care whether tourists came to Tyotin?
Part of it is because, you know, his goal with all of this was let's take these thwarted urban ambitions. We can't afford the production space. Let's take these local resources and let's merge these two things and be able to make and sell things for local and national markets. So, you know, because part of his goal is to like serve this town, as well as like his own business ventures, you want to be in a place where people want to come and where it's inspiring for anyone who comes through.
And it wasn't just him. As we said, other creative types from Seattle and Portland and other expensive cities came as well. What did they want Tyotin to be?
Well, one important thing to know about what happened in this town is, you know, Ed Marquand is very well connected in the arts community. So he had a lot of friends who, like I mentioned, needed more production space. So a lot of people that are moving in, it's more that they're moving their businesses in and their production space in than actually trying to move in and totally change this town, if that makes sense.
It's cheap production space that happens to be in beautiful mountains.
Exactly. But it's also, you know, just a place to get away and be inspired.
So did they want Tyotin to become a dream for people? Like, oh, it's made in Tyotin. It's, you can put that on your handcrafted soap, a little line drawing of the hamlet.
Right. And part of it, too, is this, like, you know, there's an interesting branding aspect.
Because, branding, yeah.
Yeah. People want to buy a product that's locally made, that has this interesting story behind it, where, you know, it's not just made in China or something. This is a product that is helping to stimulate a small rural economy in our own country, in our own state. So
made
there's
in
appeal.
America.
Yeah. There's a big appeal to that.
Meanwhile, we have this small town, rural, agricultural, 70% Latino, you said. What was it like to have something that sounds straight out of hipster Brooklyn, like Ed Marquand's book company moving in?
I think that at first people were pretty skeptical. A lot of the locals didn't exactly know what this was. They'd seen other businesses or business ventures sort of come and go. It's a little twofold. Why are all these liberal Seattleites moving into our town? I talked to the former mayor of Tyatin, and but one thing he said was, you know, it felt like these Seattleites are moving in with all this money. They're taking over the town. So there was some sort of questions around what the goals of this whole project were. And I think over time, a lot of those were sort of resolved as people started to form these relationships and understand the other, as it were.
But, you know, there's culture clash like the Music Man, River City, Iowa, who's these newcomers? And then there's more actual thorny, difficult culture clashes. Mm-hmm. Like, how has it actually gone in Tyatin with these changes?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it boiled down to politics and religion, which I kind of expected. We hear so much in a national dialogue about how these rural, more conservative communities and the very liberal, progressive urban hubs, people in these two places can't seem to reach across the aisle or talk or get along.
Right. We've sorted ourselves into different worlds and we hate each other, supposedly.
Supposedly. And it was really interesting to go into this town where those divisions do exist, the religious divides, you know, the different ideas about politics, the different ideas about things like homosexuality, and to see
Ed Marquand is gay.
And he has a long-term partner, very long-term partner. And about half of the people who originally got involved with Mighty Tyatin, the sort of arts incubator, were gay, openly gay. And, you know, in this community, religion is like very central to people's social interactions, their paradigm, the way they view the world. And there were a number of people that I talked to who, you know, were not necessarily very friendly to that on an ideological level. But because they like Ed, they like the other people involved in this organization, they kind of find ways to work around it. Whether that means just sort of blocking that reality out of their mind. And, you know, there was one woman that I spoke to pretty extensively, Pat Biggers. She's kind of the Oracle of Tyatin, they call it. Very Christian woman, very kind, very friendly. But she also had found ways for herself to sort of ignore the fact, perhaps, that Ed and Mike were a couple. Because she's very close friends with them both. And that sometimes meant things like, in my interview with her, she referred to Mike as Ed's friend, you know, and to Ed, that was like, well, yeah, we're figuring out ways to sort of navigate around these thorny ideological problems. On the other side of it, you know, Ed did not grow up in a religious family. He didn't grow up going to church, really. And there's this Bible camp that happens every year right across the street from his main storefront there on the town square. And he told me that at first, you know, he thought it was kind of annoying. He didn't like watching these kids be indoctrinated. But over time, he realized these kids have nothing else to do. They're having a great time out there. They're getting creative. They're activating this town square. What's not to like about it? You know, so I think that that sort of moral pragmatism goes both ways, where at the end of the day, people in the small community really just want to find ways to get along, which, again, totally contradicts what we're hearing at a national dialogue about these different communities.
That was producer Phoebe Flanagan. We are tweeting out a link to her story on Tyatin for Slate's Placemakers podcast right now. So we're tweeting that out to you at KUOW. We have interviewed that Seattle artist, by the way, Ed Marquand. You can find our conversation with him when you search the word Tyatin, which is spelled T-I-E-T-O-N. The father of the Boeing 747 has died. Joe Sutter, the man who connected the world by jet, was the son of a Slovenian immigrant who worked in Seattle's meatpacking industry. Sutter went to Cleveland High School and the University of Washington, and after getting his aeronautics degree, he turned down a better job at Douglas Aircraft in California in favor of a new job at Boeing. KUOW's economy reporter Carolyn Adolph has more of his story. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
What was Boeing like in the, this would have been the 60s when Joe Sutter began there?
It was a simpler time. A guy like him could have a big impact really fast, a very creative thinking engineer with a lot of talent that was recognized early. He's the guy that moved the engine from the tail of the airplane to the wings, where they belonged, he said, for which he received a check for $50.
$50, huh?
That's what it was.
The father of the 747, what does that mean?
It means that from 65 on, he was embroiled in the design and he led it. They started out with the idea of basically a double-decker plane, and they simplified it, well, or they eleganted it. They made it into the world's first wide body with the two aisles on the lower floor, and then they created an upper deck that could be, well, you know, anything, really, including a lounge.
So Sutter led the team that created the 747. And what have you heard about what it was like to be on that team?
Well, you know, they call them the Incredibles for good reason. These were not just the people who were working on the design of the aircraft, but they were doing everything else. They were building the infrastructure that the plane needed while the plane was being designed. And everything was a problem. All of the scaling up of the aircraft just created a myriad of engineering problems. And you'd have people working for days on end, and the boss would be like, okay, Sam, go home, have a shower, visit the wife, have a meal, come back in 12 hours. And the guy would just drive around the block, sneak in a back door, and get back to his problem. So people were highly committed, and Barry Ladder was one of them. He told me at first they couldn't even visualize the engines because they didn't have a wall big enough to put the diagram on. They figured it out. Anyway, here he is talking about the impact of the leadership.
Between the leadership we had from Mel Stamper, from Joe Sutter, from people in the engineering business, the leadership that those people and the example that those people set made everybody feel they were incredible. And it didn't matter what kind of an obstacle came at us. I think there was a general feeling that we could overcome anything.
Carolyn, how is the world different because of Joe Sutter?
Joe Sutter's creativity gave the world an airplane that opened up air travel to everyone. A big aircraft that you could fill in New Delhi and fly everybody to London lowered the price of the individual seat. And that's how the world really started to change. People began to be able to travel and to imagine new lives. It simply changed everything. And I'm going to let Barry Ladder tell you more about that.
This airplane opened up commercial aviation for an awful lot of people who, for reasons of airline capacity or reasons of economy, would not travel very far. This airplane made the world a lot smaller and still continues to do that.
And how about our little piece of the world? How is the Puget Sound area different because of Joe Sutter?
Well, in the first place, we got what was for a long time and may still be the world's largest building, which is the great big building in Everett where the 747 and many of the other Boeing planes are built. It also changed the way the world looked at Seattle. In this way, you know, this great glamorous plane touches off a jet setter life and starts a new way of living around the planet. And it originates here. And that just increases the world's curiosity in Seattle.
Carolyn Adolf, KUOW's economy reporter, talking about Joe Sutter, who died on Tuesday. The National Air and Space Museum of the Smithsonian Institution called Joe Sutter the father of the 747. His plane, the biggest plane the world had ever seen, had its first flight over Western Washington on February 9th, 1969. The plane's serial number was 001. And if you'd like to see it today, it's on display at the Museum of Flight.
Jumbo jet, jumbo jet, zwing. Jumbo jet, jumbo jet, zwing.
Jumbo jet, jumbo jet, zwing. Jumbo jet, jumbo jet, zwing.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.
Hi, my name is Kim Brook. I live in Ferndale, Washington, and your last show that you just had on about technology and privacy. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is a scourge, technology is. If you want to talk about Big Brother and control, that is it. And paper, mail, your phone lines, you know, everything works better than this. This is stupid, in my opinion. I hate technology, and I don't use it. I've only had it for a year. And if you live out in a rural community, you really don't have the internet or anything, you know. So we're probably a little more into information and privacy via the mail.
KUOW social media producer Bon Huberman. What was that about that we just heard?
Hey, Bill.
Hi.
So Kim called in yesterday after hearing your story about Tenta.
Yes, the mobile browser that makes it impossible for anybody to know what you're looking up on your phone.
Correct. So the developers of Tenta say that without privacy, we aren't really free, mm-hmm. right? And mainstream browsers make it too hard to keep our internet searches private.
Right.
And as you heard, Kim is probably on board with their ideas. But another listener, Paul, tweeted at us, "How am I not free already? Could be I'm speaking from privilege and naivete, but I'm not overly concerned."
Yeah, I can relate to Paul. I may be concerned. I may be slightly troubled, but not to the point where I'm probably actually going to act on that.
Okay, well, I want you to hear this. So you might want to learn more about what sort of data is being used when you use, for example, social networks. Okay. A recent article in the Washington Post lists 98 personal data points that Facebook tracks when you use it.
Personal data points, meaning like more personal than the ads that I've clicked on? Because I know Facebook knows that.
Right. So, for example, these are just three. The size of your home, the car you drive, the stores you shop at. And according to the Post, they track that even when you are not on Facebook.
Okay. That's more extensive than I knew. And I'm still probably not going to actually figure out how to do anything about it.
I believe that, but I also believe that knowledge is power. So I'm tweeting out a link to our listeners so they can read that article.
Okay, very good. Kim is going to have to, you know, call and order a back issue of the Post. For everybody else, though, who's not Kim, we are on Twitter at KUOW. In case you missed it, we'll also share the interview with the makers of Tenta, that private mobile browser. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now, when you go grocery shopping, you're just picking up some food. What must it be like for the food you pick up? Well, in the new animated film Sausage Party, that food is overjoyed to be going home with you.
Welcome, shoppers.
Ketchup, mustard, oh, sausages and buns. I can't be.
Set them straight, boys! Hey, look at this! We've got one!
Yes! We're chosen!
Yes!
Yeah! We've been chosen together!
Yes, everything looks so promising until the food finds out what actually happens to it when it arrives in your kitchen, which is very, very disappointing. And apparently so is the experience of making this movie, according to some of the Vancouver-based animators who worked on it. CBC radio host Stephen Quinn says a media workers' union has filed a complaint against the Vancouver studio behind the film Sausage Party.
Well, the union is complaining that essentially the animators were mistreated. They weren't paid overtime for the work they did, that the working conditions weren't very good. They were under a lot of pressure. Some of them say that they were, in fact, left off the credit list. And this all started when there was an article posted on the website Cartoon Brew. It was an interview with the directors of the film about the challenges of making a super raunchy animated feature. And all of the comment section filled up with people saying that they had worked on the film, people who had had previous experience with Nitrogen Studios, which made the film, saying that unpaid overtime and poor working conditions and so on were the norm. The problem is the comments are largely anonymous. They can't be verified. But the animators, who are perhaps the most critical, say that they don't want their names out there because they are actually afraid of being blacklisted. The animation industry here in this town is still pretty small. Everybody knows everybody. And if they speak out, they're afraid it's going to cost them work.
But Vancouver is so well established as a great place to make movies, at least live action movies. Is the animation scene different?
Well, it's not as big as the live action scene here, and you're right. I mean, we've just come through one of the biggest years ever in film and television in this city. There are trailers everywhere, but there seems to be this divide on how the two industries work. Animation isn't really regarded in the same way the movie business is, the motion picture business is. It's treated more like a high-tech job or a gaming job or a programming job. And in fact, there's a stipulation in the BC Labor Code that says if you work in a high-tech industry, you're exempt from having to be paid overtime. An employer doesn't have to pay you overtime. But it's interesting because in the regular movie business, the live-action movie business, the unions are very strong. You know, you've got the Directors Guild of Canada and the Teamsters and IATSE and Unifor as well, representing all of those workers. It's very formal. You know, you have to tick a lot of boxes, especially, obviously, for the union productions. There are non-union productions as well. But none of that seems to apply to the animation business. And so that's what Unifor is really doing here. They want to get in and kind of organize the animation business.
What does the studio say about the complaint?
The studio hasn't had much to say about it except to issue a release saying we followed all employment regulations and everybody was treated fairly. And to be fair, on that Cartoon Brew website, there are a number of people who say, you know, you guys are a tiny minority of whiners. I don't know what you're whining about. We had a blast working on the movie. Nitrogen Studio is great. Dismissing, basically, all of the complaints.
As you said, this complaint sounds like a risky move for animation workers who don't want to be punished by the studios. What do you think is going to come from this complaint?
I don't know. I mean, if anything, this has drawn attention to it. There's been an awful lot of reporting on it here. I don't know whether it will lead to the reclassification of animators as, you know, something in between programmers and people who work in live-action movies. But it does feel like that overtime exemption shouldn't be applying to them because they all say, you know, we're not monkeys who sit at a desk and punch keys all day. You know, we're artists. We're in the process of actually making a movie here, and we should be treated like everybody else who makes movies.
Finally, Stephen, let's widen the lens now for one final story because Canada got some quite bad economic news this morning. What's going on?
Yeah, and not unexpected. And all of this has to do with the shutdown of the Alberta oil sands, or a good part of it, as a result of the wildfires that we had earlier in the year. So with that shutdown came a drop in Canada's GDP of about 0.6%. So zero growth in the second quarter of this year. In fact, worse than zero growth, a recession, essentially, although technically we don't call it a recession when it's only a single quarter. But it is the worst month of GDP that this country has seen in the last 7 years. It is expected to bounce back in the fall, partly due to the fact that there's a new scheme underway for a Canada Child Benefit. This was introduced by the Trudeau government, and it's actually, for middle-income families, it's fairly generous. You know, if you earn $90,000 and you have two kids, you're going to see nearly $500 dropped into your bank account every month. And since consumer activity is a huge driver of GDP in this country, they are expecting it to bounce back for the fall. The other thing is that there are billions of dollars lined up for infrastructure spending right across the country right now. This is a government that didn't campaign on balancing budgets last fall. It campaigned on borrowing piles of money and spending it on infrastructure. All of those plans are in place, but that money hasn't actually gone out. Nothing is being built just yet. So the feeling is that once that happens, we'll also see a bump in GDP for that.
Stephen Quinn hosts CBC Radio's On the Coast, talking about, unemployment and trouble at Sausage Party, which, by the way, I saw last week. I want to warn you, if you're thinking of taking children to a cute cartoon movie about hot dogs, don't do it. Don't do it. Rated R. Having said that, I'd give it 3.5 sausages, but I know many of our listeners don't concur. This is KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Earlier this hour, we met one of the thousands of refugees who've come to Washington in the last few years. Well, we also have at our website a visual look at where Washington's refugees come from, where they settle, and how Washington ranks when it comes to taking in refugees. I learned, for example, that the top-ranked state for welcoming refugees, I would have guessed California, Maybe New York? Nope, it's actually the red state of Texas. Texas has resettled almost as many refugees just from Myanmar as Washington brought in from all countries in that same period. You can see that article for yourself at KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning in.